Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here's your moderator, Mr. Raymond Ibrahim.
Thank you. Welcome to another Middle East Forum conference call. Our guest today is Mr. Lee Smith, a visiting fellow at the Hudson Institute and author most recently of The Strong Horse. Mr. Smith will discuss the significance, or lack thereof, of the WikiLeaks, particularly as they pertain to the Middle East. Over to you, Lee.
Thank you very kindly, Raymond, and thank you all for joining the conference this afternoon. I'm not going to speak too long, and I hope we have a chance to for a question and answer session at the end. I've written about the WikiLeaks. I've written about the WikiLeaks issue now about three times, a couple of times for Tablet magazine, where I write a weekly column, and once for the Weekly Standard, where I'm now a senior editor. Those three different articles are evidence that I'm of a mixed mind about the WikiLeaks release, the release of all these, of what will eventually be close to 250,000, a quarter of a million diplomatic cables. Right now, I believe we're somewhere, between 1,500 and 2,000 have been released. So I think there are both positive and negative elements about these, about this release, and I try to separate that from the toxic personalities of Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, the people responsible for these leaks. I'll just start off by saying one of the things that I think is what I think is of interest for the Middle East Forum and what is of interest for me, and I think that what is of interest to most people occupying the center-right part of the political spectrum in the United States, and certainly regarding the Middle East, is that these WikiLeaks cables bear out much of what, much of how we understand the region. And maybe I shouldn't be speaking for other people online, but I will speak for myself. So my first response, I have to say, when I looked at the news coming out of these WikiLeaks cables was, again, this was evidence that more or less bears out how I tend to understand the Middle East, which is that the Arab-Israeli conflict, the issue with the Palestinians, this is not the central issue in the Middle East. Rather, there is conflict among a number of different, especially Arab actors we're looking at, and mostly an intra-Arab conflict. And this is what we find described in the WikiLeaks cables. Among other things, we find, as we believe, that our Arab allies, especially in the Gulf, but including the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and Egypt, are quite concerned about the Iranian nuclear program, especially, one of the things that comes across quite powerfully, not just the Gulf Arab allies, but Hosni Mubarak as well, is quite concerned about what the what the Iranians are up to, and for good reason, due to Hamas's project in Gaza. So I think all of these things are positive, that it shows that this understanding of the Middle East, what I like to describe as the Arab Cold War version of the Middle East, which is that the Middle East is mostly determined by actions between the particular actors of the region, for instance, Syria, Egypt, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, all this competition in the region, this is what defines the region. And it's not the West, it's not the United States, and it's not Israel. The other positive aspect I'll say about the WikiLeaks cables, which I'd say this was something of a surprise to me, but that to date it's shown American ambassadors, American diplomats, our foreign service officers to be extremely good at what they do. I think this probably comes as a surprise to many people who are used to thinking of the State Department, our institution, our institutional memory of foreign policy to be something of a weak link, especially regarding the Middle East. We're accustomed to thinking of the State Department as a bunch of Arabists who take the Arab opinion on the Middle East. But again, I think that what the WikiLeaks cables show is that is that our diplomats there do a very good job of reporting and transcribing what they hear and what they understand about the region. Now, I should say that as I've explained it to other people, there was a senior administration figure from the Bush administration, and when I said this to him, he said, well, that's true, but what you need to keep in mind is we've only had a few of these releases. We've only had a fraction of these cables released so far, and what we'll see in time is that with 250,000 of these cables released, what we're going to see is a lot of the problems that we've always understood with the State Department. So while I'm saying that I think to date these cables have shown that our diplomats and foreign service offices have done an extremely good job, we also should be on the lookout for some of the telltale signs and some of the things that we are used to associating with the State Department. The same person from the Bush administration also explained to me, he said, look, it's sort of what journalists do. Journalists go and they pursue a story and they look for quotes to vindicate the story that they want to write. He said this is the same thing that happens with Foreign Service officers, especially in some of these classified documents. You go into a room and you have one Foreign Service officer and one confidential source, and what's going to happen is a lot of these quotes, a lot of the topics are going to be piped. He explained to me, he said, look, if journalists do this, you can only imagine how bad. At a certain point, a journalist needs to get someone to go on record, needs some sort of source for a story. Well, this is not the case with Foreign Service officer reporting. So this is one issue to look out for in the future. Now, I'll use that as a transition to describe some of what I perceive to be the real problems with these WikiLeaks cables. I think the first most obvious is that it makes us look weak and it makes us look incompetent in the Middle East. That's certainly one way to understand it. This is the way that a lot of people have described it. It makes us look as though we don't know what we're doing. I would say I think that's partly true. The other danger, though, is that it does make us look like we know what we're doing. I think throughout the Middle East, everyone assumes that we always know exactly what we're doing. There's always a plan behind it. There's always a project. And therefore, people have got to be wondering why we have released these cables intentionally. Why are we mad at Hosni Mubarak? Why are we mad at the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? Why are we mad at Saad Hariri and the March 14th movement in Lebanon? Why are we mad at the Turks? Exactly what are our reasons for wanting to expose all of these different people to very sensitive, with a very sensitive information that they've given us, or with very sensitive topics? So again, I believe that this is the way a lot of people in the region understand what's going on, that these leaks, it's not unintentional. They would assume that this is a preposterous cover story, that Bradley Manning and Julian Assange are behind this. They assume rather there's at least one or other. They assume that the American intelligence community is behind this leak, and that we're leaking this for very good reasons. The reasons, however, they don't know yet. Another problem which I've written about, and this seems to me, well, I'll go over some of the smaller problems first, then I'll go to what I think is the very big problem, or one of the very big problems. People have noted that this will scare off some of our assets and resources throughout the region, and I tend to believe that's true, and other people do as well. However, I quoted, I spoke to him for one of my stories, and he's written about it himself, Ruel Mark Gerecht. And Ruel, as some of you may know, Ruel worked in worked with the CIA, among other places. He did work with the Iranians and in other places in the Middle East. And one of the things that Ruel told me was, and this was for attribution in my story, so I'm not revealing anything that he doesn't want known, but he said, look, I handled different assets in places, handled different people in places where our sources and our assets were slaughtered. And he thought that at that time there was no way that people were ever going to come back to the United States and speak to us again. He said, for better or worse, that turns out not to have been the case, that shortly after these people were slaughtered and butchered, people nonetheless came back and wanted to speak to the Americans. And the fact is that we are the lone superpower. We are still the major power in the region, and people want to and need to speak to us. Now, Ruel, being someone from the CIA, he also understands it in bureaucratic terms as well, rather in terms of intra-agency competition inside of Washington. And one of the things that he said with a little bit of glee, and he wrote about this in a New Republic article, he said that one of the things this will do is this will encourage people to speak to the CIA rather than the State Department, because the agency will be able to promise and provide more secrecy and confidentiality than the State Department has been able to provide. So again, I know that this has been a large concern of people that no one will speak to the United States because we've shown that we can't keep our secrets, but again, this is just not the case. There are people who have explained that we've done much, much worse, and people come back and speak to us regardless. The thing that I think is a real problem is we've really muddied the flow of information. And right now, a lot of our rivals and adversaries throughout the region are using the WikiLeaks cables to advance their own interests and to hurt us and to hurt our allies and friends in the region. I'll just give one quick example before we go to the Q&A section of the call, and that is there's a paper out of Beirut, a pro-Hezbollah, pro-Syria, pro-Iran newspaper out of Beirut called Akhbar. And Akhbar has been running for a while they were running a number of different cables. Now, it was actually quite confusing what happened. It was not clear how many of these cables really come from the WikiLeaks cache or not. Early on, Assange himself had muddied the water somewhat by explaining that there would be cables that would go to smaller local markets that wouldn't go to the four main papers that he had given the WikiLeaks, that he'd given the cables to. Akhbar seemed to have been one of those outlets. The information that they were running was extremely damaging to U.S. allies in Lebanon, especially from the March 14th movement, and is extremely helpful to Hezbollah, the Iranians, and the Syrians. What happened about 2 weeks ago was the Akhbar website was hacked, which suggests that, well, I mean, we don't know yet who did it, whether this was, and certainly Akhbar was turning around and claiming it was the Israelis who'd done it, but it was much more likely that the Americans had something to do with it, or even the people who were behind WikiLeaks. They actually didn't want this information revealed, and it's still not clear how many of these cables this paper Akhbar claimed had come from the WikiLeaks cache were authentic and how many had been fabricated. Indeed, this is one of the major concerns. How much information now is going to be fabricated that does not actually come from these leaks, but will serve the interest of various U.S. adversaries and enemies and hurt us, hurt our interests, and our allies in the region. So for me, this is the real concern, how people are going to use this confusion, and they're going to add to the confusion to hurt us in the region. So that's a brief summary. Let's turn it over now to your questions, and let's see how that goes. Thanks very much again for having me this afternoon.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, to join the question and answer session, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I'll announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. And please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. So again, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad to ask a question. Now our first question comes from the line of Mr. Bob Gazzardi. Go ahead with your question, please, Mr. Gazzardi.
Lee, one question about the statements themselves. What makes us believe that what was being told so-called in secret to the State Department diplomats was in fact what the speaker really meant? After all, I'm speaking to a diplomat. I'll say to that diplomat what he or she wants to hear. Publicly, I can say something different. Which is the true statement, and how do we know what is authentic?
Well, thanks for raising that, Bob. This is actually something that I've written about, and also something that Daniel Pipes has written about as well, and I think this is a very interesting issue. Even when, I mean, many people made a big deal out of the fact that the Gulf Arabs were telling us how terrified they were of the Iranians and to do something about it, that we needed to do something about it quickly. My personal opinion is that the Iranians constitute an enormous issue for U.S. strategic interests. We don't need to be listening to either the Arabs in the Gulf or even the Israelis for that matter. We need to be acting on behalf of our own interests. So, but I use this as an example to ask this very question, Bob. How much do we know that this is what the Arabs really think, or is it just what they're telling us because they need to get on our good side? And this is the work that intelligence agencies are supposed to do in terms of counterintelligence. I think the most important thing, the most important thing that we can do is that we can describe what is important for U.S. interest. So I think we can separate it out quite clearly like that. Whether or not it's good for the Gulf Arabs for us to do something about the Iranian nuclear program, it seems like it's an important thing for U.S. national interest. But I think that's a very important question. How much of this is really what the Arabs believe, and how much are they just telling us because this is what they believe that we want to hear?
Thank you for your question, Bob. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. And now back to our moderator while we wait for questions.
Yeah, Lee, thanks for all that that overall insight, which I appreciate. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the WikiLeaks reveal about specific countries and regimes, more specifically than the general overall.
That's very interesting. I would say I think there are two countries that come out of it very. Well, I've been focusing on two things because it seems to me that most of the things that we know from the WikiLeaks cable, we already knew. As you and I were speaking about briefly before, in a sense, we can sort of regard the WikiLeaks cable as sort of cliff notes about the last 10 years of what's gone on in the Middle East. Because everyone's brushing up for the final exam for 2010, you sort of go through these notes and go through these cables and figure out what's been going on. So a lot of these things we already knew, and it's sort of like brushing up on these different things. Well, the things that we didn't know that clearly, we didn't actually know how the United States, how our diplomats, how the State Department regarded Turkey. And one of the things we now know is that even though Washington has been speaking, since 9/11, since the election of Erdogan and the AKP government, that Turkey represented this sort of great combination of Islamism and democracy. And I think a lot of us, certainly Daniel Pipes, I think probably yourself, I can't remember whether or not you've written about this, but that this was a misreading of what was going on with the AKP, and this was a misreading of what was going on with Turkey. Well, as we now see, it turns out that Washington has also been fearing this for a long time, and that it seems that Washington also seems to have a pretty clear reading on what's going on with Erdogan and these people. The different people who have been, there's Jim Jeffrey, there's Eric Edelman, so our different ambassadors who have been in Ankara have a pretty accurate reading of what this government, what Erdogan, what the Davutoğlu, what these people are up to. So I think that that's especially interesting. The second most interesting revelation for me about particular countries is Qatar. And it's not just what our diplomats say about the Qataris. It's also what the Israelis and others have said about Qatar. You know, one way that we've understood Qatar for like the last, I don't know, the last 5 or 6 years is sort of a Damascus of the Persian Gulf, or sort of a Gulf spoiler, where they're actually not very helpful, and their major role is just to get inside and mess things up. And it seems that other people in the region are quite aware of this. You know, there's the now outgoing Mossad chief, Meir Dagan, who was very open about Qatar. He said, you know, they're a real pain. He said, no one likes them. He said, the ruler is a real, you know, is a real pain as well, and no one likes him. And that you should get your, talking to the Americans, he said, you should get your bases out of Qatar. So these are the two that I find especially interesting. The other ones I find, again, they confirm the sorts of things that we've thought, the sorts of things that we believe. You know, when we look at Egypt, when we look at the Saudis, and we have a good idea of what we think they believe, again, this confirms it. I will say one more positive thing about the WikiLeaks release in general. I will say that what this proves is it proves that you can get, or you can understand the Middle East, you can understand this region, as much as we hear how complicated it is and how opaque so many things are, what this proves is that you can understand the region from open sources. As long as you're not an ideological fanatic, as long as you're not one of these peace process nuts, if you go in open-minded and if you look at the region and read this stuff open-mindedly, you can see what's happening. You can look at the broad general shapes of the region and understand, as we see now, perfectly what's going on. And the WikiLeaks stuff gives us some more detail, but what it does, again, it really sort of confirms the general picture that we had of the region before. The irony, of course, is that it's people who are on the right center part of the American political spectrum who are called the ideologues, even though, again, here we have this confirmation that our understanding of the region is the accurate one.
Excellent.
Excellent, thank you. And now we'll take a question from the line of Mr. Michael Moskowitz. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hello, Mr. Smith.
Hi, Mr. Moskowitz.
Hi, I saw a story today on Haaretz, actually, through Jihad Watch, originally showed up, and it's talking about how Syria helped orchestrate the Mohammed cartoons, quote-unquote, outrage. How could we use this to, I believe we need to get to the point where we are able to burn the Quran just like we are able to burn the Constitution and without people trying to murder us.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Ahmed Ibrahim might have thoughts on that, but how could we use this to point out the obvious that they are orchestrating these things?
Well, I think this is a very interesting point, and this is, I'm very glad you raised this. Actually, Raymond and I were speaking about this a bit before, I believe. I was in Beirut at the time. I'd spent some time in Damascus going back and forth, but also, you know, we had problems in Beirut as well, which was also orchestrated both by the Syrian regime and by the, you know, by what was then the ostensibly pro-Western March 14th government, which was using this, you know, which was using the Muhammad cartoons to sort of attract power for the Sunnis and to try to leverage that power against Hezbollah. I think one of the things that this reveals, and one of the very, very important things that we need to understand, is a lot of these things that seem to come out of the blue, or they seem to play on Muslim rage, or have nothing to do with Muslim rage. What these things have to do is, this is organized regime politics. It's organized regime strategy. And this is why whenever I talk about terrorism personally, I don't do counterterrorism, but when I talk about terrorism, I always want people to understand that this stuff is driven by regime interest. It's driven by the Syrians. It's driven by the Iranians. If we look at what happens throughout the region, this is the way that these regimes fight and deter each other, through these terrorist groups. So this is a very, very important thing that we need to keep in mind. When everyone wants to talk about being sensitive to Muslim sensibilities and not doing this and not doing that, we need to understand who stirs this up, who gets the people out on the street. It's the regimes. and they're doing it on behalf of regime interest. So I don't know exactly how we turn that into a, you know, I would say that what we need to do is we need to turn the debate away from Muslim sensibilities and respecting Islam, and we need to start talking about how the regimes are using this stuff. You know, not making it a, for us, not making it a religious conflict or ideological conflict, bracketing that, putting that to the side. Because I would say, look, one of the important things is I talk to a lot of people about this, and they want to emphasize the role of Islam, which is no doubt important. But we're talking about here, we're talking about a Syrian regime, which is ostensibly secular. It's not a Sunni regime. It's a minority Alawite regime. And so if we just talk about Islam, if we just talk about Quran, then that lets us, and what happens is it lets off regimes like the Syrians. And this is exactly what they want. Because their whole thing, they come back to the Americans and they say, hey, look, we're very concerned about Sunni extremism too, just like you are. We share an interest. Of course, the problem is not Sunni extremism. The problem is how regimes like the Syrians use this ideology to fight for their own interests. So I think, from my perspective, this is one of the key things that comes out of this, one of the key things that we learn, to keep talking about regime interests.
Thank you for your question.
Lee, I just wanted to have, it's not so much a question as an observation, which I hope you could elaborate on.
Okay.
At one point you said that one of the revelations of the WikiLeaks is that the State Department and those types of people are actually doing a good job, and you made the comment that I think that they're not taking what one would expect, that is an Arabist approach to the Middle East. Can you elaborate some more on that?
I spoke to a number of people about this, including some people who had, you know, who had worked at State Department. I said, well, this is what State Department people learn how to do. Report. This is the most important skill that's taught at State, which is reporting. So they're very, very good at that. Now, it doesn't mean that people come out of there and after they've reported that and they've written down accurately, say, what the defense minister, what the Emirati defense minister writes down or what the Emirati defense minister says, it doesn't mean that they necessarily interiorize that. And they say, oh, if this is true, then it must therefore be true that the real problem here is the Iranians, and it's not settlements in Malaya, you know, it's not building on to existing settlements somewhere in Israel. So they don't necessarily interiorize this information, but they report it accurately. But the caveat that I did want to give before is, even though I said that I've been surprised by how accurate the reporting was and I've been quite pleased by it, I've had other people warn me and say, yes, so far this is what we've seen, but invariably after 250,000 of these things, we're going to see some very bad and sloppy reporting as well. So that's what I meant. I think that we can be happy that what we've seen so far is good reporting from our Foreign Service officers. But there's going to be some bad reporting as well. And we wish that this reporting, that this view of the world that comes out in the reporting, that our State Department would interiorize this. And they would say, if this is true, then what else is true? Or what else must be true? Maybe that'll happen eventually.
Very good. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the conference call, and so I'd like to take this opportunity to thank everyone for joining us, and a special thanks to you, Lee, for providing us
with your
insights. Thank you.